Hello and welcome to Meandering with Myrn, a potpourri of podcasts by me, veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. Join me as I ponder any and all things animal and human, what we know and what we don't, where we've been, where we are, and where we're headed. Have you ever noticed how sometimes we like to put things in little mental boxes? I think that's pretty common because it makes us feel like we're more in control of the situation. Then after a while, when we begin to get more confident with what's in our little boxes, some of us start to stretch the limits a little bit, think outside of that box. Let me give you an example of how this works. I'm sure you all know people who label themselves dog people or cat people or horse people, and their whole lives revolve around that one particular species. Within that group, there are even those who live in smaller boxes. These boxes not only confine them to one species, but one particular breed. Sometimes the walls of these boxes are so thick, it's not just a case of the person ignoring the existence of other animals of the same or different species. It's a case of them viewing those other animals as threats. So in a way, they function like fundamentalists who worship in the church of the dog or the cat or the Abyssinian or the golden retriever. But if you watch little kids, although they may initially be attracted to the family dog or the family cat because that's the animal with whom they have the most interaction, there also seems to be, at least in some kids, an innate attraction to life. So while they may spend most of their time with the family pet, their attention is also captured by insects, lizards, worms, spiders, birds, pretty much anything that moves. And then a funny thing happens when you start becoming interested in wild animals and their behavior. The limits of the box may start to stretch again, and suddenly the environment becomes important. Where these animals live, and what happens to that environment. And then once we start paying attention to the environment in which the animal lives, then we get to the next step. And the next step is a little bit more troubling for some people. If you look at the human-animal bond studies, you'll see that there are more studies that are creeping in that involve plants. Plants, you might say? Excuse me? Plants? What are plants doing in human-animal bond studies? Well, it turns out that plants have some of the same positive physiological effects on humans that animals do. But plants are troubling, particularly for that group of people who view themselves as being morally superior for not eating animals or using any products that came from animals. Because in order for that philosophy to work, plants can't possess any of the characteristics that cause those people to elevate animals above them. As it turns out, though, that's the box they live in. I first became aware of this years and years ago when I was in high school and read my first James Bond mystery written by Ian Fleming, in which Bond noted that when a rose is picked, it screams. That shocked me. And I decided Fleming's a fiction writer, he made it up. But it turned out he didn't. It turned out that when a flower is picked, when a vegetable is picked, there is a change that one could interpret as a scream. I found that very uncomfortable, so I just sort of tucked it away and forgot about it. But then, as I became more and more interested in ethology and communication, I found myself paying attention to plant studies as well as animal studies. For example, another study I came across way, way back when noted that when certain trees were attacked by certain parasites, they changed their chemical makeup and they communicated this change to other trees who then altered their chemical environment so they would be more resistant to that same parasite. Whoa, I'm thinking. This is what some species of animals do. Crush an earthworm and the earthworm gives out a scent that warns other earthworms. stay away, change, do something differently. Same thing happens with sea urchins. But then we have all those alarm calls that animals give out. So now we have both plants and animals who conceivably feel pain, who can communicate with each other, who give out alarm signals. And then more recently, some studies that looked at kin recognition. Kin recognition in ethology and animal behavior is a really, really big thing. How do animals of all different species recognize their kin? And how does this affect their behavior? Well, it turns out that plants apparently have methods of kin recognition too. If plants whose seeds came from the same mother or plant are planted close together, they don't compete with each other for resources in the ground. They don't put out as many lateral roots as they would if they were planted next to a plant that wasn't a relative. At the same time, though, if they're planted next to their kin, their leaves are more likely to touch. Whereas if they're planted next to one having different parents, they're more self-contained, they're more aloof, they keep their leaves to themselves. Now, for people who like things nice and neat, the idea that the more you know, the less you know, can be very disconcerting. Because the other thing about being able to put things into boxes, it makes us feel better, it makes us feel superior to think that we choose to save animals by only eating plants. And then when somebody comes along and says, wait a minute, looks like those plants, you know, they might be doing some thinking, they might be doing some emoting. All on their own. Now what? Studies like these force me to acknowledge the fact that we're all in this together. I'm as much a part of them as they're a part of me. And you know, once you do that, you're not living in a box anymore. Once you realize that, the limits are so far out there. They're infinite.
You've been listening to a podcast by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries and books about animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavior and bond sites, check out my website at www.mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the content of these podcasts are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music, Molly on the Shore by Percy Granger, is used with permission from Catova Arts, www.catova.com.